Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to the author of Orgies of Feeling, Melodramatic Politics and the Pursuit of Freedom, published by Duke University Press in 2014. The book is written by Elizabeth Anker, who's going to be joining us. I also had the pleasure to have a guest host for today's conversation. Lily Gorin joins us to speak with Elizabeth about her book. I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Welcome back to the podcast. Again, I have the pleasure to have read and to talk today to the author of Orgies of Feeling, Melodramatic Politics and the Pursuit of Freedom, published by Duke University Press, Elizabeth Anker. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you for having me on here.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have you on. And I have the double pleasure to have a guest host today, Lily Gorin, who's going to be helping out with the conversation. Has also read the book. Lily, how are you doing
today? I'm fine. Great. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, Lily, you are our guest host, and I'll give you the chance just to introduce yourself just a little bit. So the real brief of who you are, who are you?
Well, professionally, I'm a political science professor at Carroll University, which is located just west of Milwaukee in Waukesha, Wisconsin. And I am intrigued by Libby's book, because it integrates ideas of popular culture, which I study, gender, which I study, and political theory, which I study and teach.
Yeah, wonderful. It's great to have you on and joining us. Libby, how about yourself? I had the pleasure just over the weekend to open up my alumni magazine and find an interview with you about your book. So tell us about yourself and where you are.
Great. So I am an associate professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and I'm a professor in American Studies and Political Science.
Wonderful. It's great to have you both on. Let me start just by asking kind of one of the big questions, you know, the kind of question that somebody who's not a political theorist might ask. And that is about some of the basic terms, even in the title. To get us started. So I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about the idea of melodrama and also the idea of this phrase orgies of feeling, because they have some particular meaning for your book. So would you explain them just a little bit?
Sure. So melodrama, when we often use the term colloquially, means the kind of heightened affect, lots of drama, you know, lots of crying and screaming, kind of hyperbolic emotions. And when we think about it in terms of film or literature, it usually means a kind of narrative with all these heightened affects and emotions, characters who are often either really good or really bad, good and evil, a situation that generally travels from a victimization of the good person by the evil villain, and towards the end, some kind of restitution where the villain is punished and the victim is redeemed. So in my book, I look at how we think of melodrama, which is usually we assume it's just kind of storyline from film or novels. And I look at the ways in which it concretely shapes U.S. politics and political discourse, especially in terms of foreign policy and the war on terror. One of the things I'm most interested in is not only how melodrama works in political discourse, but kind of why citizens are compelled by it. What makes melodrama so compelling as a political discourse that in times of stress or crisis, that's the narrative we turn to make sense of the United States and its role in the world through these narratives of villains, victims, heroes, where the U.S. is the victim and the hero and some other nation is the villain out to punish it. And we're, you know, lots of kind of heightened emotion in our rhetoric. And we're led to believe that eventually the victim will turn into the hero and kind of reach out and experience a sense of freedom that is equated with the punishment of villainy. So Orgies of Feeling to me helps to explain why citizens are compelled by this. And in an orgy of feeling, which is a concept taken from the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, an orgy of feeling is when a single instance of kind of victimization and injured, a kind of single injury, seems to take over for all of the small injuries and the small forms of suffering that we experience in our life. So that a single instance of injured freedom comes to be our substitute way of understanding all the other ways in life in which we feel disempowered or vulnerable, or that we don't have the kind of agency that we want. So I took Nietzsche's reading of Orgies of Feeling to try to understand why a narrative like melodrama might be so interesting or important or valuable to American citizens. And it seemed to me that something like the War on Terror, which is a single instance of injured freedom, comes to stand in for all of the ways in which U.S. citizens so otherwise feel that they are vulnerable and disempowered, and that the way to solve the War on Terror through the kind of acts of war and surveillance end up seeming like ways that can actually erroneously, I think, solve all of the kind of more common forms of powerlessness that citizens feel in the 21st century.
Now, Lily, you are no stranger to melodrama, let me just say, having written about it in the past. What do you think? Maybe you can add to our conversation with a question.
Well, I mean, I was delighted as I was reading through this book because it's such an interesting perspective on understanding a sort of a broad cultural feeling, and you know, and the terminology that Libby was using with regard to Nietzsche's take on orgies of feelings. And I did wanted to ask Libby, in this context, of course, you have this narrative with regard to the victimization leading to ultimately the restitution of the hero or the heroism of the country or the individual. But you also discuss at length the fact that this sort of melodramatic trope doesn't apply to all groups within the United States. And could you talk a little bit more about that in context?
Sure. I mean, melodrama is very interesting in this way. I think when people use the term, and certainly when politicians or the news media use melodrama, they are trying to describe what they imagine to be a very generalized national identity, where everybody in the U.S. is feeling injured and victimized, and everybody is going to legitimate the state actions that will lead to heroism against the source of villainy, whether that villainy is terrorists or communists in an earlier era. But part of the work that melodrama does is it identifies a form of suffering that it says constitutes the kind of experience of being American at that moment. But it leaves out all the forms of suffering that are not reducible to being injured by terrorism. So all of a sudden, all the ways in which we are kind of striated as a nation, all these kind of unequal forms of power relations that might otherwise contribute to our understanding of what it means to be a suffering American. We can think of racism, sexism, poverty, discrimination. Those things don't apply. So on the one hand, melodrama is trying to speak of a very large situation while also leaving out all the other forms of kind of injury and violence that are done within U.S. national identity. On the other hand, especially when we think of the specifics of the War on Terror, who gets left out of this narrative is often people who look like they are Arab or Muslim, or they identify with one or the other. Both of them are so often conflated in U.S. public discourse. So something like in the wake of 9/11, if you are Arab or Muslim, the only way to be included in this national identity of an injured American is if you kind of profusely display your patriotism, you renounce other people who share your faith or background identity, you promise that you will kind of, you know, infiltrate your normal communities and populations in search of people who might share terrorist proclivities. So there's a way in which there's another kind of form of violence that's done to the oftentimes less explicated but very clear boundary between who gets to be included in this we and who does not.
Now, I wonder if you could just talk in some specific terms about what you looked at. So you looked at the more recent time period and also the past, but what are some of the cultural objects and texts that you look at in this book?
So I start off the book with kind of what I think is one of the kind of key moments in at least the post 9/11 a form of melodrama, which is the media coverage of 9/11 itself. And I try to do a close reading of it, almost treating this media coverage as if it's a film, to see what are the tropes? How are these melodramatic tropes working? How is it not just the way the news newscasters or people who are, the politicians who are being interviewed from across the political spectrum, what is the language that they're using? But also, what are the editors doing in the newsroom? How might some of the video montages themselves be shaping the coverage in a very melodramatic way? How can we pay attention to the sound behind the coverage itself and how the sound is kind of evoking Hollywood narrative of an action film where the hero is about to you know, is about to kind of punish or kill the villain. So the news coverage of 9/11 is really important to my thinking about how that set the tone for how we came to understand the 9/11 and its aftermath. I also look at lots of political speeches and look at the way speeches are evoking particular melodramatic tenets. I look at certain films that do some of that work, films like Zero Dark Thirty, which is, you know, about the capture and killing of bin Laden, films like Three Kings, which have a kind of interesting relationship with melodrama. And then I also look at even forms of political theory in the present that that use melodrama for a kind of counter melodrama or a leftist melodrama that's intending to counter the standard melodrama of war and militarism in U.S. politics, but that is also drawing on melodrama in order to do so.
Lily, what do you think?
I think this is such a rich exploration of this understanding of melodrama that I also wanted to ask Libby a little bit more in terms of your original sort of discussion of the sort of nation as victim, but also in context of how you are describing sort of freedom and injured freedom. And you also discussed sovereign freedom. Could you sort of put that into the context of not only the examples that you use as you're looking at this perspective of the injured freedom, but also in terms of what you mean by it in terms of the sort of the victimization of the United States as an entire country?
So one of the things that both melodrama in the Cold War period and melodrama in the post 9/11 period draw upon in politics is a sense that when the United States is injured as a nation, part of what is being injured is its freedom. And I look at what freedom means in that context, because, of course, we know as political scientists, freedom can mean a whole host of things. One of the things I was most interested in is how freedom is so often articulated through a notion of sovereignty, through state sovereignty, and in particular how, again, state sovereignty can also mean different things. What it means in this context is often the U.S. as kind of the having the main control over global affairs, or at least having a significant power in global affairs. It's something that Judith Butler has called thinking of sovereignty as a national entitlement. Right, something that the nation that is kind of owed or entitled to the nation as a global superpower. So not just freedom over its own territory, but also freedom in deciding its relationships with other nations. So when we have a sense of what's being injured here, there's both a sense of a kind of state sovereignty that's not able to kind of exercise power in a form of a kind of deep control over the global order. But there's also a way in which this plays out in the individual. A sense that the individual has a sense of a waning sovereignty or a lost freedom. And so as we've noticed in general in the last 10, 20 years, the way that state sovereignty has been waning in thinking about lots of global forces like transnational capital or resource wars and things of that nature, we can also map onto that a sense of a loss of individual sovereignty, kind of sense that power has become so centralized in these transnational levels that even individuals have lost their kind of access to governing power, oftentimes don't seem to have the kind of agency that either they feel that they've had in the past or that they've imagined, especially when they imagine that form of agency to be a sovereign one. So I look at how melodrama is working at both of these levels to try to tell us that freedom is injured both at the state level and at the individual level, and also how enacting some of these really large kind of forms of state sovereignty in terms of war, occupation, surveillance, that those can actually bring back a sense of lost sovereignty, not only to the state, but also to the individual. I think this is also what makes the melodrama that I'm looking at particularly an American form. You know, as I was presenting parts of my project across various venues, a lot of scholars in comparative politics and area studies have told me that some of the nations they've looked at could also be described as using some forms of melodrama to articulate their own national identity or their own political discourses. I think that's really interesting, and I would love to see more scholarship on that. Where I focus on the U.S., and I think one of the ways in which what makes the U.S.'s melodrama a particular U.S. form is the way it emphasizes the injury as being something that's about sovereign freedom, and also the promise that these kind of acts of global control can also be equated with a form of freedom. So it's a kind of violence at the state level that we imagine as expressing a form of sovereign agency.
I had in reading this and Lily also knowing some of the stuff that you've written, I had a kind of a question for both of you, which is about just the acting and the response to your writing, where you're integrating, deep, important political theory and what some might view as lowbrow culture. Libby, I've heard you I've read something where you were, that's some of the reaction to some pieces of what you do. And I wonder if Lily, first, you might have any thoughts about that and reactions to your work on that sort of treating the content of television, the content of popular movies along these ways, and what kind of reactions you've gotten to that.
Well, I mean, I think I've had some of probably the same responses that Libby has, in that you have to often make a case for the validity of looking at aspects of popular culture. And popular culture is really extensive in terms of what you're talking about. Libby concentrates on news media and films. I've often looked at television substantially to look at sort of understandings of gender politics. But then there's also music and video games and so forth, and fashion, all of which contribute to popular culture. And oftentimes the immediate response from people to some degree outside of those of us who sort of take popular culture seriously is, well, what's the value in that? And the value is oftentimes in large measure, as Libby has so well explained in her book, that there are narratives embedded in what you are sort of just soaking up unknowingly, that oftentimes reify concepts that you have in the back of your head that are political. And so, there is this issue with regard to the fact that popular culture, while, is commercial and it's selling advertisements or it's selling movie tickets or it's selling games that you play on a PlayStation, is also sort of translating a lot of experiences and understandings of a nation, of gender, of dynamics among people that you're not even aware of. You're integrating those ideas into your everyday sort of thinking and interactions with others.
And Libby, how about yourself? What about some of the reactions when you write a book and title it Orgies of Feeling? There's the, you must expect some types of reactions from the those that don't read beyond the title of a book. How has been the what has been the reaction to your work?
Well, first I want to say I love the way that Lily just explained the kind of importance of popular culture and the way that it speaks to these larger desires that are, incredibly important for understanding the political. So thanks, Lily. Sure. Yeah. So as to the title, it was one of those things where my mom was like, do you need to put orgies in the title? Can you just go with what goes after the colon as your main title? So, I get that. And of course, part of the term Orgies of Feeling is itself the kind of melodramatic spectacle, that it is gesturing to and also describing. One of the things for me is that, as you can probably already tell by my disciplinary affiliation right now, my work intends not only to kind of speak to political science, but also to American studies, a field that takes American culture and transnational culture very seriously, and understands it in all the ways that Lily described it. So for me, I'm always trying to balance these different audiences of how do you speak to the kind of heightened importance that we attach on politics and the political, while also expanding what we mean by politics and the political in ways that will make our work readable and relevant to multiple disciplines outside our own, but disciplines that are also understands themselves to be studying politics just in a different way than we might in political science. So I hope that, the title alone was meant to do some of that work, but also the kind of work of sowing melodrama and making a claim for melodrama as an important political phenomenon, right? Of melodrama as something that is a discourse that legitimates state power, a discourse that shapes national identity and that infuses foreign policy directives. It took a while to be able to make that claim even before the book came out, and to make sure that it was speaking to audiences in all of these domains.
Lily, the last question is yours.
Oh, the last question is mine. I guess I just wanted to follow up on sort of the broad concept that you're working with, Libby, and ask about not only sort of the implication for sort of domestic politics, because a lot of what your focus is on the United States on the world stage, but you do discuss in the book some of the implications for domestic politics. And particularly the rise of something like the Tea Party. And I was wondering if you could sort of make a little bit more of that case in terms of how the sort of injured freedom of the individual has now taken form in, say, I don't know, the candidacy of somebody like Donald Trump.
You know, I hadn't thought about it in precisely that way with Trump, but I 100% agree. And I think that, you know, when everybody's so befuddled by why his just kind of angry rants and racist proclamations, how they can be galvanizing such a large swath of the population. I think the way that he's performing that injured freedom of the individual really speaks to that. I think we can see how that also takes place in immigration debates in general, and the way that immigrants, or especially immigrants from Mexico and South America, are so often positioned to be the villain of a kind of victimized U.S. populace that is losing its jobs or losing its state funding for welfare or something like that to these immigrants, and the way that melodrama plays out in language to really legitimate the racism and the violence that happened on the border. So there's a way, of course, melodrama will work in different ways, and it might work in a different way for someone like Donald Trump than it might work in the larger kind of anti-immigration rhetoric that we see periodically erupting. But I think in both of those, this sense not only that freedom was injured, but that there's a sense that the individual deserves a robust sovereign freedom, a freedom that often translates not only into self-mastery, but mastery over the external world and one's surroundings. The sense of that is an entitlement, I think, comes out in all these different iterations, in part because I think as we enter a very globalized era, and certainly an era where the U.S. has a waning power in relation to the rest of the world, that sense of an entitlement of a sovereignty, of a kind of masterful sovereignty, is eroding at many levels. And part of these reactions are part of a larger phenomenon of people reacting against that and trying to reclaim that sense of sovereign agency for themselves in ways that are often quite violent and discriminatory and racist.
Now, Lily, I hope that the next time you're on, maybe, is with your next book project.
Okay.
Before we finish up, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about what you are working on next that we might look forward to in a future podcast.
Well, I'm going to put a plug in for my book that came out in March that Libby was kind enough to blurb on Mad Men and politics, nostalgia and the remaking of modern America, which was an edited volume about the television show Mad Men and takes up a lot of these sort of discussions of narrative understanding of the United States as it was growing in the post-war period as sort of fictionalized by Matthew Weiner on the television show.
Wonderful. It's something that I think everyone needs to go out and read. And Libby, how about yourself? What's your next project working on?
So my next project is tentatively titled Ugly Freedoms. And it's trying to look at all the ways, both a kind of similar taking off from Orgies of Feeling in the sense of looking at how freedom is often used to legitimate these very kind of ugly and despairing situations of war, of domination over others, of slavery, and looking at, you know, how freedom is part of the rhetoric that's used to justify those actions. But then also looking for how do people practice freedom today in situations that might seem despairing from a position of sovereign freedom, right? Situations of deep non-sovereignty or deep interdependence with other people and other things. Situations of despair or disorientation, and looking at different sites like that in terms of climate change, both the way that freedom legitimates destruction of the climate, but also the way that freedom can be found in challenges to that, and also looking at that in terms of the free market economy and contemporary racism.
Right. The current book, Orgies of Feeling, Melodramatic Politics and the Pursuit of Freedom, published by Duke University Press. Elizabeth Anker, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was great to talk to you both today. Thanks again.
Yeah, and Lily Gorin, thank you as well.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.